This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Every adult life could said to be defined by two great love stories, writes Alain de Botton. The first, the story of our quest for sexual love, is well known and well charted. The second, the story of our quest for love from the world, is a more secret and shameful tale. That second story is the subject of a new book named for the powerful urge that all of us feel to find a place of honor and respect in society, and the perhaps even more powerful drive to avoid public failure, status anxiety. How do we measure status changes? The aggressive virility that earned a man a high place in ancient Sparta would have cut little ice in Victorian England, for example, so these measurements change, but every culture decrees winners and losers, people with high status or low. Later in the program, high anxiety. Mount Everest claimed 7 more lives this climbing season. We'll talk about who goes up and why. But first, status anxiety. This often unspoken worry is the basis of some societies, and figuring out escape routes from the honor-shame loop has consumed many of our greatest philosophers, tragedians, and comics. So what is status today? How do you measure it? How do you know if yours has gone up or down? And if you have a story about how you've dealt with a change in your status, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Alain de Botton, the author of Status Anxiety. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why is the pursuit of status, as you describe the love of the world, such a secret and shameful tale?
Well, I think the origin of the whole thing lies in the way that everyone used to have very, very high status. If you look at the way that babies and small children are treated, they enjoy a level of treatment that a Roman emperor would have envied. If they're hungry, someone brings them their food on a tray. If they don't like the food, they can just throw it on the floor. Someone will pick it up. All they need to do to raise a smile is just to sort of wave a toy around, and everyone will find them cute and interesting. But by the age of 25, if you're still throwing your dinner on the floor and you're still waving a toy around to get smiles, no one's going to pay attention to you. So all of us suddenly enter into a new adult world where what matters is not what you are, but what you do. And this is terribly anxiety-inducing. George Orwell once said that after 20, no one cares if you're nice. The implication being what matters is, you know, what you do. And when two people meet for the first time, they do tend to ask each other, well, what do you do? And according to how you answer that question, you'll either find people being very interested to have a drink with you, or else saying, oh, is that the time? I must be off. So a lot hangs on what we do and on our performance. And all of this is, you know, very worrying, because all of us want to be treated with respect and dignity.
And that's what you point out, that in that first great quest for love, sexual variety, there can be, a lot of broken hearts along the way, but a lot of broken hearts in this second pursuit of love from the world as well.
That's right. I mean, and it's very painful, because basically I think we're surrounded by people who in my book I call snobs. Now, the word snobbery is often associated with old sort of British concern for aristocracy and hunting and shooting, etc. That lets too many of us off the hook. Snobbery is alive and well. And basically snobbery is any method of judging a human being whereby you latch onto one or two things about them and come to a conclusive view of their character. So, for example, if you were to meet a music snob and you told the music snob that you loved the music of Phil Collins, it didn't matter how interesting and rich your soul was, you know, you would be a nobody. And of course, the dominant kind of snobbery that exists in this country today is career snobbery. It is, you know, what do you do? It's your achievements in the workplace that sort of defines you. And I say in my book also that the opposite of a snob is your mother. Not necessarily your mother, but as it were, one's ideal mother.
And I'm glad we're not talking about my mother here.
the nice thing about your mother, I mean, some mothers are snobs, and that causes a great problem. But the nice thing about the ideal mother is that she doesn't care what you do. She cares what you are. You know, that's what really matters. But most people, unfortunately, are not our mothers. Most people do respond one way or another very critically to the news of what we do. And that's why people, of course, are so attracted to getting status symbols. You know, we're often used to mocking people who want, you know, luxury brands, luxury goods, etc. And we can call these people materialistic. You know, they're not materialistic. Really, all that they're doing is using material goods to make a very simple statement, which is, please like me. You know, next time you see someone in a Ferrari, someone arriving at a party in a Ferrari, this person isn't just interested in, you know, fancy Italian engineering. Really what they're using their car to do is to say, you know, treat me with respect. And the thing is, they're not wrong. I mean, if you arrive on a bicycle, you will be treated with less respect than if you arrive on a Ferrari, in most places. So there's a kind of emotional poignancy to our pursuit of luxury goods that's often missed when we adopt a kind of critical, anti-materialistic line. Because it's not about materialism. It's about, as I say, it's about love in a way.
It's also about labeling. And you write that we are quick to label some as losers. And you write about the story published many years ago in France about Madame Delamere, an adulteress, who was her story was taken by a great artist and turned into the story of Madame Bovary. But nevertheless, you know, you have to compare what we know about this woman after having read this novel to the headline we might have read the day her body was discovered, a shopaholic adulteress swallows arsenic.
That's right. There's almost no tougher word that's out there in our society than the word loser. And it's interesting that, you know, wind back the clock 400 years. 400 years ago in England, people who hadn't done well in life would be called very discreetly. They'd be called unfortunates. They'd be called unfortunate. Nowadays, they're called losers. And I think that tells us a lot about our society. One of the things it tells us is that we think that life is a game, and it's a fair game. You know, we believe that our society is a meritocratic, and that if you have talent and you have energy and you have something to say and do, you can get out there and be a success. And of course, you know, there's a cruel side effect to this idea of meritocracy, because if you genuinely believe that those at the top deserve their success, you almost by definition have to believe that those at the bottom deserve their failure. And that's why you get in this language of losers and, you know, that very harsh expression, winners make their own luck. You know, the more a society believes itself to be fair, the more that society will be tough on those who are perceived to have failed, you know, because of something they've done wrong. So there's a lot of personal shame and responsibility for what happens to us.
We're talking about status with Alain de Botton. His new book is Status Anxiety. If you've ever suffered from this or know people who have, call and tell us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's talk first with Amy, who's with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a very interesting topic. I'm a teaching assistant here at the University of Arizona, and I find this topic fascinating. I think that with my students, they are many of them are consumed by this idea of status, and I think they find, especially we're a very large campus, with a particular look that's dominated by, and I would say this, visually, I think it's dominated by what is generally associated with the Greek or sorority kind of aesthetic, where there's a way of dress, a type of dress. And my students find this to be very hollow in look, but they do everything they can to mimic it. They talk about it vocally, and they, even though it's a limiting kind of look that they have to play in, they do still, I can tell, they're functioning almost at the secondary or high school level in that they want to be accepted and they want to belong. And so this tends to run amok among the students, or they talk completely against it as if they're above it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered what your guests thought about this, because they talk about it at great length when we get into aesthetic and the quality of objects, what they're wearing, what they're buying, knockoffs versus originals. And they have a very strong opinion about these things, but I feel that they always fall back on kind of running to the Target to get the designer knockoff or to the...
Let's get a response from Alain de Botton.
Well, again, it would be easy to describe your students as just being materialistic, but I think that would be wrong. It's simply that in your particular school environment, material goods have been invested with emotional meaning, so that if you wear a certain kind of clothes, you're not just thought to dress well, you're thought to be a good and important person. And that's the way it works in a lot of life. I mean, a lot of the reason why people are interested in money, say, is not for the material goods it can buy us, but because making a lot of money is seen as a sign that you are a good and honorable and worthy person.
Alan, you know, let me not be too much of a cynic about this, but is it also not, if you're not dressing as others do, you're not merely not good, you're scorned?
That's right, you're scorned, you're a nobody, you're literally ignored. Now, to some extent, of course, human beings have to find a way of judging each other, you know, you can't, and judging each other relatively quickly. But I think there are these very crass and crude ways, whereby you literally take a look at someone's car or someone's clothes and you come to a definitive view about them. And I think that's one of the stories about growing up. You know, one of the stories of growing up is that you can find a way of judging your inner worth in a way that doesn't depend on the immediate judgment of other people. When I was writing my book, I came across the example of duelers, people who for hundreds of years, if someone said, you know, you're an idiot or, you know, your wife's sleeping around or something, they would have to challenge the other person to a duel. And hundreds of thousands of people were killed in Europe in the course of duels. And you'd have to pick up your sword or your gun, your pistol, in order to try and kill anyone who ever had a bad opinion about you. And that just shows how vulnerable all of us are to the opinions of other people. You know, some of us, you know, if someone shows you disrespect, you literally want to try and kill them. But of course, that's the way to madness. That's no easy solution to these things. So I think all of this shows that part of growing up means learning not to take the opinions of everyone so seriously, learning to discriminate between the opinions that you want to listen to and separating those out from, you know, the chatter of the playground, of the group, of the office, or whatever it happens to be.
And that's where we get into philosophy, is it not?
Well, I mean, philosophers have traditionally, I guess, stood outside the group, the marketplace, and have said, you know, let's make a distinction between truth and opinion, what people think and what may actually be the case. And one of the things, you know, if you talk to older people, one of the things they often say is they say, the great thing about growing old is I don't worry so much what other people think about me. Now, that isn't to say that they don't care at all what anyone thinks. It just means that as you grow older, sometimes you're able to make a clearer distinction between the opinions that are valid and the opinions that are not valid. So it's not that you grow deaf to everyone, you just grow more discriminating. And I think younger people find this very, very hard to do, particularly small children who are incredibly sensitive to the opinions of absolutely everyone. They can't discriminate at all.
The sticks and stones may break my bones. No kid ever believes that.
No, that's right. I mean, it doesn't. It is an achievement. It's an achievement of maturity to be able to do that. Also, I think, you know, to reflect on death. I don't want to sound morbid for your listeners, but traditionally, the idea of not listening too much to other people was connected to the idea of reflecting on the fact that your life isn't that long. There was a long tradition of putting a skull on your table, on your library, on your sideboard, and looking over at it during the day, so as to think not everything is meaningless, but rather to think, you know, some things are meaningful and some things are not so meaningful. And I think anyone who's ever had a close brush with death will tend to tell you that their priorities were rearranged. Some things came to matter a lot and some things came to matter not so much. And I think it's very easy to lose perspective, especially when we're living in cities, we're surrounded by media, we get an image of what's hot, what's in, what's out, etc. And I think one of the ways in which people have calmed down about status anxiety down the ages is to sort of step out of that. And one of the things that can help us to step out of this sort of rat race is to think that, you know, we don't have that much longer left to live. Death is coming, etc. Or I hear your piece on Everest coming out soon. To take a walk in the mountains has traditionally been a wonderful way of escaping status anxiety. To think not, you know, who's slightly bigger than me, but to look up at a huge mountain and go, you know, there are things in nature that are bigger than any human being, and that can be often be a very consoling and sort of perspective rendering activity.
Or as Alain de Botton argues in his new book, another good escape is to read or see a tragedy or maybe just go see a comic. We'll be talking more about status anxiety after a short break and taking more of your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. If you have a story to tell, if you have concern for status and how it has driven choices in your life, get in touch with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Alain de Botton about his new book, Status Anxiety, and taking your calls if you'd like to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. An email from Jeff Hsu in Portland, Oregon. Status symbols may be about wanting social love, but how do you explain why people don't curb their purchases of such things as Hummers when there's so much public disdain of such over-the-top goods?
Yes, well, I think there's a distinction between, I mean, we can sometimes think love is that you literally want everyone to like you in an obvious way. Another thing that people use status symbols for is to humiliate other people and to say, you know, look how important I am. You may not like me, but you're going to have to accept me. I'm going to make a loud noise. But, you know, so it's not, you know, love suggests that we want literally people to, you know, to be nice to us. But you might want to irritate people. But if you scratch below the surface, what's the person trying to do with an SUV or a Humvee? They're still trying in some way to get attention. They still want to be made special. It's just they've associated getting attention and feeling special with a kind of aggression. But scratch below the surface of that aggression, and it's still, I would allege, still in a way about a kind of love. It's about feeling that you're important, that you're respected, that you're noticed. It's just that some people interpret taking being noticed in a slightly more aggressive way than other people.
It's also possible for people to be searching for a status symbol and make a mistake. They just pick the wrong one.
That's right. That's right. And one of the great cruelties of our society, I guess, is that we're told that everyone can have very high status. That, as it were, everyone can be extraordinary. You know, that's as it were the American dream, that everyone can be extraordinary. And in a way, lots of people can be extraordinary, but not everyone. And the great question, the anxiety bit of my status anxiety, is that it's about the way that, you know, what do we do when we've tried to, you know, achieve high status and we failed? What do we do in a world in which everyone is told you can be special, but where not everyone can be special? It's probably as unlikely today that you could become as rich and successful as Bill Gates as it was unlikely in, say, the 17th century that you could become as rich and powerful as Louis XIV of France. But the key thing is it never feels that unlikely. In fact, you know, depending on what magazines you read and what shows you see, it can feel as if, you know, if only you have a bright idea, know a little bit about software, have a garage, you too could be, you know, be the founder of Microsoft or something like it. So there's this permanent sense of possibility, which really aggravates people's peace of mind. And I think, you know, I've just been walking around several large American bookstores, and I think the interesting thing is if you go to the self-help section, there are basically two kinds of books on sale in these self-help sections. There's books telling you how to make a lot of money fast, you know, how to become a billionaire by Friday. And then the other kind of book is telling you how to cope with low self-esteem. And I think the two are really related, because it's by the time, you know, it's Saturday and you haven't made your billion that you're going to be reaching out for a book telling you how to feel better about yourself. So there is a link between the despair that some people will feel and the amount that we are told, you know, you can be anything, you can be anyone. That's actually it can be a remarkably cruel thing to say to someone.
Let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. Bill is with us from Oklahoma City.
Hi, guys. Fascinating
Hi.
Subject.
Thank you.
I want to bring up the idea of status dichotomy. I was in the Air Force for 20 years. And the civilian world does not have a very good opinion of you, especially since I joined during the Vietnam War, and there was actually hostility. But in the Air Force, I made rank very quickly. And so besides having an armful of stripes, I had a young face to go with it, and this was a high status. But in the civilian world, once I took my uniform off and mingled with neighbors and all that, you get this patronizing attitude that you're a step above the welfare people, you know, the employer of last resort. You know, I was a member of Mensa. Then the other thing that happened is I retired at 39, and I never worked again. I'm still retired. And I thought society will approve of me now because, you know, how many people can retire at 39 and have no debt? However, you're looked upon as a bum. You can't date women. Well, you can, but they're suspicious. Oh, when guys say they're retired, that means they're just out of job. No, I don't have any debt. But the status dichotomy was so interesting, and I didn't have a problem with it because I got my status fulfilled at work, but I missed my status when I left the Air Force. No longer had that armful of stripes and the young face. And it really surprised me because I thought I'm the least status-conscious person I know.
I think that's a fascinating thing because it shows that status is something that always exists within a given community. And actually, you know, the United States, for example, any country, is always going to be made up of many, many different kinds of communities. So let's say you've got the military community, you've got the community of poets, of writers, of merchant bankers, of engineers. And each of them, or in all of these communities, we find status, you know, hierarchies. And the thing is that sometimes you can have high status in one group and then shift to another and have very low status, and, you know, and vice versa. So, you know, you can be a very important poet and then you meet an investment banker and the investment banker just thinks you're a joke, etc. But I think that this reflects, I think your story reflects just a more general feature of life, which is that we can never hope to impress everyone. That, as it were, our status, however we determine our own success, we won't be able to convince everyone. We will at some point meet with these people that I call snobs. You will find someone who will not be impressed that you're retired, who will not be impressed that you're in the military, etc. And I think, you know, whichever, even if you try and tick all of society's boxes, you know, if you do all the things that you're supposed to do to be a good and successful American, you'll still find some groups that will think, actually, you're not a good and successful American. There's something else. And I think the only way to cope with this kind of thing is to recognize that you can't carry everyone with you. That, as it were, you can't convince everyone of your specialness and dignity, etc. You will always have some people who are going to go, well, actually, I don't agree with that definition of success. And maybe that's something to celebrate. We do live in a pluralistic society where we can shift from community to community, and different things are valued in different communities.
Bill, it also suggests
Absolutely, because I got all my status needs more than by the military, and I was kind of... I thought it was kind of funny what the civilian world would think, because I'd take college classes off duty, and you know, they patronize you, they're in the military, you're lucky to be here at all, and I'd get the highest grades in the class. And then they had a problem with that. You know, you didn't fit your class. You know, you were, what was the old thing they said about, he knows his place? And military people don't get the highest grades in the class. They don't know their place.
It also suggests we're a pretty shallow bunch, and maybe those opinions shouldn't mean much.
We sure are.
I think we are traditionally very, very shallow, because basically what we do is we look at a few things about a person, you know, their job, where they've come from, what are they doing, and we use that to come to a definitive view of who they are and how good they are. Now, scroll back the clock, go back to Christian times. You know, the old Christian idea was that you would look at, that no one could judge the merit of another human being, that, as it were, everyone's value as a human being is mysterious, and that the only person who can tell how good or bad someone is God, and he can only do this on the day of judgment with a large pair of scales and 1,000 angels. Now, this could sound very weird to anyone who's listening from a secular perspective, that's my perspective, but nevertheless, there's something interesting, because it goes so against that modern meritocratic view, which is you can look at someone's CV, you can look at their resume, and decide how good they are. You know, tell me where you've worked, tell me what you've earned, and I will tell you the kind of soul you have. And that's kind of mad. I mean, that you know, human beings are much more complex than that.
Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Let's get another caller in, and this will be Mike, who's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Neil. How, Elaine?
Hi, Mike.
Elaine, you've hit the nail on the head. I also believe that this is an extremely important topic, not just because it's interesting and because it might be relevant in each of our lives, but in trying to get a fairer, more utopian, more loving society. I think as scientists, we have to be aware of these principles involved in status seeking and status faking. And I want to recommend a paper to everyone. Its title is Power and Self-Deception. It's written by Mario Heilman, and you can find it on Google very quickly by just searching with two search term string. The words are Trivers, T-R-I-V-E-R-S, and Hare, H-A-R-E, who are two authors. I was actually looking for a paper they wrote together, but Hare is not mentioned in the Heilman paper, but the Hare Krishnas were.
Hare
is spelled H-A-R-E, so... Trivers, and Trivers has views very similar to Heilman. So when it found,
I guess
Trivers,
that's a rabbit of a completely different color then, yes.
Heilman paper immediately, and it's a great paper and would be a wonderful companion to read with Elaine's book.
Well, interesting you should mention this. We got an email from Seth at the University of Minnesota. He writes, what I think is that status has become the evolutionary capital, where it used to be that physical endowment was the greatest asset to our ancestors. Intellectual and monetary capital have become the new desirable traits in a person that will allow them to pass on their genetic structure.
I think that's a very interesting point, because a lot of people say, well, you know, surely status anxiety is just biological. It's, you know, what's the point of writing a book about it and trying to think about it? Because it's just natural. It's natural to seek status. And I think that's absolutely right. It is natural to seek status. But, and this is a big but, every society gives status to different kinds of people. And that's, as it were, a political point, broadly defined a political point, which is we have to decide who in our society should get status and for doing what. And, you know, many of the great political debates, take feminism. Feminism was all about one group in society saying we deserve high status, higher status than we have. And it is remarkably easy, actually, to change the status system. It's much easier to change the status system than it is to change the political or financial system, because really all you're doing is you're giving people new kinds of role models. You're saying, actually, you know, a woman who, you know, is intelligent and works, she deserves high status, you know, etc. So you're changing people's perceptions of who is a successful and valuable human being. And society, you know, in history keeps showing great changes in our sense of who is a success. The word success is a very, very flexible one. So I think, you know, in a way, the moral of my book is to say, yes, of course, success is important, but let's try and make sure that our ideal of success is something that we've reflected on, that is actually something we've thought about rather than sucked in uncritically from, you know, our school, our teachers, our parents, those around us.
Let's get another caller in. Sally's with us from Milwaukee.
Hello. Yes, I was just calling from my perspective of having recently moved to, well, the big city from a lifetime of living in small towns in the countryside, and how I feel so pressured all of a sudden to identify myself by what is my status in society, what is my culture, and issues of race coming up, too. There's things that I really never had to think about before, and it's so disturbing for me because I come from such a very good liberal pedigree. I mean, my father was a civil rights worker in the 60s. He went down to Selma to march with Martin Luther King and everything, so the idea of being racist is abhorrent, and yet I find myself in a situation where there are enough people grouped together, so it seems like people just sort of naturally divide themselves up. And
I think that's a very interesting point about the way that moving from the countryside to the city can hugely increase status anxiety. And I think there is, to a large extent, status anxiety is an urban problem. It's, and of course, I mean, you can live in an urban way in the countryside. I mean, I can get onto that. But I think there's a way in which if you're surrounded always by other human beings, if you're surrounded by examples of other human beings' success and their ideas of success, etc., you know, it's the atmosphere of the rat race. And I think one of the ways in which people have calmed down about their status anxiety traditionally has been to leave the city, to go out to the countryside, to look at the ocean, to look at mountains, to look at things that put things in perspective. But of course, that's, you know, ever harder to do. But we're one of the first societies really to have at the center of our culture only a worship of other human beings and other human achievements. Our heroes and heroines are all just other humans who've done special things. And, you know, whereas past societies always had right at their center a worship of something else, nature, a deity, some supernatural force. Of course, we don't have that. And I think, you know, to be permanently surrounded by other human achievements can increase our sense of our own impotence and our own small size in relation to other humans.
We're speaking with Alain de Botton. His new book is Status Anxiety. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line and talk with Rebecca, who's with us from Salem, Oregon.
Hi. I just wanted to comment with what you were saying about status anxiety in cities. It seems to me that when status anxiety acts within a city or within a group of people in the city, it often leads to gentrification efforts and crackdowns on homeless people and the people at the margins of society. For example, in our city right now, the city council is thinking about pulling out the downtown bulletin boards that are often used to advertise things like punk concerts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think causes group status anxiety like this, and what can people in cities do to overcome it?
Well, I think one of the things that causes group status anxiety is the feeling that if you end up at the bottom of society, your life will be really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that status anxiety is very linked to what would it be like to be an ordinary person in a city or in a place? The countries where status anxiety is least are countries where to be an ordinary person is compatible with a life of dignity and respect, a life where you can have relatively good quality housing, you know, you don't have to have a humiliating job, etc., etc. As soon as you have a situation where, as it were, life could be comfortable at the top, but if you end up at the bottom, life will be absolutely horrible, then you create a kind of sense of panic, whereas, as it were, the fear of being a loser rises to such an intensity, and you, as it were, want to opt out of the community. Community breaks down because community becomes disassociated from anything that's nice. And this is the sort of the vicious circle that people can end up in. Everyone wants to opt out of communal provisions of, let's say, housing or transport or schools, because it's so horrible. And this is, you know, it's a really big political problem.
Rebecca, thank you. I'm not sure that settles the situation there in Salem, but we appreciate the question.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we get one more caller in. This is Jason from Oakland, California.
Hi there. I just wanted to mention, I mean, living in a big city, you deal with subcultures where there's an anti-status status of people who live their lives more eccentrically and are gauged not just on talent in the workplace or in an artistic world, but upon living their lives in an anti-aesthetic aesthetic, if that makes any sense. I was wondering if you touched on that in your book, the idea of subcultures.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on... I have a whole chapter in my book on bohemia and the idea of a bohemian life. That's often mocked nowadays, like bohemia is just something that, you know, was very last century, etc. I think it's a very beautiful and noble and serious idea, the idea of a counterculture, as it were, to live with the dominant culture, but slightly in opposition to it or to the side of it or in some kind of dialogue with it. This is something that life in the big cities of the United States has become ever harder because the big cities are getting so expensive.
Yeah, but my friends and I joke around about being new bohemians, but it seems almost impossible to exist.
Well, I think
in a sort of place where money is so important.
That's right. I mean, in a place like Manhattan, which of course has a long and very noble bohemian tradition, it's now more or less impossible to lead a bohemian life. But I think it's still possible to lead it in perhaps some of the smaller cities of the United States, and that's where I think we can go to look for bohemian life, which has traditionally been, of course, one of the great ways in which people have stood aside from the dominant status concerns of most people and have said, yes, we are interested in success, but you know, we're trying to work out a different vision of success, a vision where perhaps money will play slightly lesser role, perhaps a vision where art or friendship or fellowship will assume a slightly larger role, or whatever it happens to be.
Jason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Alain de Botton, we thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Of course, I assume you've gotten some higher status as a result of being our guest on the show. Of course, you still have that New York Times book review waiting to come out, so I guess you've got some status anxiety of your own.
That's right.
Alain de Botton's new book is Status Anxiety. The author is also the author of How Proust Can Change Your Life. When we come back from a short break, why people risk their lives to breathe where the air is thin. The drive to climb Everest is next. If you'd like to join that conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.